For example, one person's body satisfies the other without implying any kind of sexual relationship. Sensual relationship normally begins as emotional, and unless controlled, tends to become sexual. As you notice immediately, friendship except for the two highest, the supernatural and the spiritual. Although they are called friendships, they are in many ways intimate relationships between two people, either of whom or each of whom finds satisfaction in the other person. To that extent, therefore, they are not real friendships, because while they are mutual, it is possible for two people to get mutual satisfaction from each other, each seeking selfish interests. Now, it can happen that, for example, one person obtains an intellectual satisfaction from another person, and the other may obtain emotional or sensual satisfaction from his or her partner. So it need not be intellectual on both sides or emotional on both sides. One may satisfy the other intellectually, and the other may satisfy the first emotionally or even sensually. Finally, sexual. The spiritual masters talk about sexual friendship, even though they don't really mean that a couple are engaged in a friendly relationship, because friendship properly understood always means selfless love of the other person. Now, as we know, in the world, sexual relations can be masked in many ways. The people may think they are somehow in love with one another, whereas actually they are using the other person to satisfy themselves. The subject of sexual friendship, I think, deserves special treatment, and I think we're going to go into that, not in this class, but later on. Let me just say a few things regarding so-called sexual friendships. The moment we say sexual, we mean that the people get sexual satisfaction from one another. The sexual satisfaction may be quite interior and yet be morally wrong, because, as we know, we are forbidden outside of marriage to deliberately enjoy any sexual pleasure. We are forbidden even to arouse it deliberately. And if aroused without our intention, we may not deliberately indulge it. The sexual friendship, therefore, may begin in many ways, and this is where people, I would say, long before they enter the consecrated life, must have been able to distinguish between what they are aroused to do and how much they can take. In other words, I would say the single most important thing in avoiding sexual friendships, which are sinful, is to know what are my limits. What can I take? What are my, what I call, sex stimuli? First, in general, they differ between men and women. With women, sex stimuli tend to be more psychological. With men, they tend to be more physical. If another person, therefore, I find from experience, tends to arouse my passions, I must, therefore, avoid whatever, before God, I realize is sexually stimulating. And I cannot say that what I am doing in itself is not a sin. Thus, one person can arouse another person. Whenever I find that, I am obliged, therefore, depending on how strong the stimulus is, I must avoid anything which in that person arouses me sexually. Now, one of the problems in religious communities is that the person may arouse another person of the community indeliberately. There may be no evil intention. Nevertheless, if I find that I am aroused by another person, I must, as far as possible, avoid those relationships with a person that would be for me an occasion of sin. I would say here that superiors have a grave obligation to recognize when they see that a person is a temptation to someone else. There is also an obligation on the part of those in a religious community to, as far as possible, manifest their conscience to superiors. And it is no comfort to say, well, I've already explained myself, say to the superior, and nothing is being done. Certain people, for example, just living with one another in the same house can be a source of temptation to one another. And until recently, not too many years ago, we didn't talk much about sexual friendships, say, in an all-women's community or an all-men's community. But now we do. In other words, homosexuality has become a grave problem in what we still call consecrated life. Now a word about problems. What are some of the problems that face those who wish to live a consecrated life, and how are they to be dealt with? I would say the first and gravest problem is that so many people enter a community with problems which have never really been resolved. And what complicates it is that a person under the influence of grace may be strongly attracted to the consecrated life. Admire those who live it. Want to imitate some person who would enter their lives. May even be people of considerable prayer. Nevertheless, they have problems which they have never really overcome. What are some of the problems they enter, say, postulancy or novitiate with? First of all, they may have had sexual experience before they entered the community. Let me tell you that a person who has had sexual experience before entering a community has inherited a problem. Those things should be found out earlier rather than later. Another problem. Depending on the kind of apostolate that a community engages in, I cannot tell you how naive superiors can be in exposing not just young, but especially young religious to situations that are more than they can cope with. In other words, for example, dealing with a person of the opposite sex, no matter how apostolic or zealous say a religious may be, they have simply got to use their heads. And as I found out over the years, with dealing by now with several thousand souls, a friendship which begins in the spirit, unless carefully watched, tends to end in the flesh. Here I am talking about friendships outside the community. What's the problem? I think the problem here is that where a community is not practicing the kind of loving charity and kindness that we all need, inevitably, a person who is hungry for the kind of affection and attention that we all naturally need, not finding it in the community, will look for it elsewhere. Finally, something about training. I would say the first thing to know regarding training people, especially young people, in the wrong kind of friendships, is to make it plain to them that it is quite possible and legitimate to have a stronger liking towards one person than towards others. And there is nothing wrong with that. Christ himself, as we know, had his chosen disciples, Peter, James, and John. And among those three, John, as he says, was the beloved disciple. In other words, that they could be protected from guilt feelings because they have more friendly sentiments towards someone. It is the most natural thing in the world, and when elevated, can be very pleasing to God. Otherwise, for example, a priest could never seriously engage in, say, the apostate and helping women. If he treated them with roughness or unkindness, wouldn't do them any spiritual good. So it's not a question of not having certain persons towards whom we are more inclined than others. It is rather that we control our impulses. So that's the first. Secondly, I think in the training, especially of young religious, they should be taught the importance of sacrifice. In fact, I would almost say the single most important thing needed in training or preparing people for the right kind of friendships in a community is sacrifice. This sacrifice can take on and should take on various forms. For example, I am drawn towards somebody, say she has qualities that appeal to me. They can be spiritual qualities, kindness, patience, a love of prayer. I admire the person. Admiration leads to affection. No problem. However, if I am to cultivate the right kind of friendship towards people for whom I have a spontaneous, friendly feeling, I must first of all sacrifice my thinking that I do not unnecessarily allow that person to be on my mind. I cannot tell you, and it's not often that I have occasion to talk on this subject, but when I do, my memory goes back to my own early days in the religious life. I never had any brothers of my own. I can't tell you what a wonderful experience it was to find kindred spirits that I could live with. I thought to myself, gosh, look what I've been missing all these years. But I soon found out that the bell rang. I was in the middle of a sentence, say, the novitiate, when we were really strict. And St. Ignatius says, when the bell rings, if you're writing, stop in the middle of a word. If you're talking, stop with a word. You just got into an animated conversation. And we're washing dishes. They were so dirty, we were late in getting to recreation. Recreation always followed the washing of dishes. Maybe 17 minutes or 23 minutes for recreation. Spend a half an hour, 40 minutes washing dishes. And we had to keep silence in the kitchen. I want to talk. So I learned quick that if I was to persevere in the religious life, I would have to sacrifice my thinking. That we don't pray for certain people unnecessarily. That's a strange statement. And a good practice, if you want to practice heroism, try this. Choose by preference, at least for a while, not too long, it may be too much, too hard. Choose by preference to pray, and you might list them, even on paper. for the people that you are least attracted to. And for a while, don't pray for those towards whom you are most inclined. So the sacrifice of thinking, the sacrifice of talking, I had long, years ago, learned to count, and I still not for this purpose now. The Lord has been good to me, but I've got to watch myself to keep a record of how long I talk with certain people. And it's remarkable. We think we're practicing charity. Maybe we are. But there's such a thing as practicing charity and giving in to my selfish interests. If young people especially are to be trained in supernatural and spiritual friendships, they must learn to sacrifice each other's company. Just to have someone nearby, even if I don't talk to the person, can be emotionally satisfying. Nothing wrong with that. The point is that I must learn to sacrifice. Let me get into an area which is delicate but very important. Our consecrated chastity means that we must learn to sacrifice exclusiveness in love. It is part of the nature of each one of us. Nature, I say. To grow in affection for one person, which in the ordinary course of God's providence ends up in marriage. And the divine precept of monogamy, which means exclusiveness, one man, one woman, until death, we sacrifice. In a community where the nature of things, they are either all women or all men, that natural tendency towards exclusiveness can become an exclusiveness towards another person of the same sex. And that, let me tell you, you may be surprised, never leaves us. And what I had to be a priest and deal with souls as intimately as a priest does, to learn, with some people become stronger as they get older. The need for some one person who becomes for that individual, they're quite exclusive friends. By which time they may have mastered whatever lower impulses they have. Nevertheless, the tendency towards exclusiveness, I know what I'm talking about, the tendency towards exclusiveness, we must master and control all our lives. Going back to my own novitiate days, we used to live four or six together in a dormitory. Every 3 months, there was moving day. Morning after Mass, we didn't know what to expect. There was a new list of dormitories on the bulletin board. We'd have about an hour, hour and a half to change all our belongings and move from the third floor to the second, from a dormitory that we kind of liked to someplace else, living with other people. Evidently, and that was 400 years of tradition behind it. Makes sense. In other words, part of the sacrifice that at first, in the earlier years, in the consecrated life, it is somehow mandated, but later on, we may have to do much of this on our own. And people later on can make such a fuss about living with certain people or not living with others that unless superiors are wise, they can, without realizing it, destroy a vocation.